Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. You know, this could be the week that the presidential race becomes about something other than Donald Trump's personality or his use of white identity politics. As you've been hearing, Trump gave a major economy speech in Detroit yesterday, and Hillary Clinton will give one there on Thursday. So for a nation racked with long-term economic anxiety, this is what this campaign is or should be most centrally about. And perhaps the most interesting thing about the Trump campaign is how he has deviated from Republican economic orthodoxy. So we'll get a specific critique of Trump's proposals now, and some of Clinton's, from a conservative who's been trying to open Republican minds on the economy for almost a decade now. He is Raihan Salam, editor of National Review Online and a Slate columnist, and author with New York Times columnist Ross Douthat of the 2008 book, Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Maybe you read their very thoughtful opinion piece in the Times last month called A Cure for Trumpism. They are sometimes referred to as reformicons, and they are not for Donald Trump. Hi, Raihan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Do you like that label, by the way, reformicon?
It's just fine. People will call you what they want to call you, and that's as good a label as any.
A reform conservative, I guess, is what it refers to. So let's give the listeners some of your ideas and see how Trump and some Clinton proposals compare. You say Republican elites have been out of touch with workers by failing to emphasize wages rather than big upper class tax cuts. So you say raise working Americans' take home pay right now in a clear, quantifiable way. That's in your article. And this is not just about the minimum wage, right?
No, it's not. So when you're looking at wages and the sources of wages, you've got to look at a variety of different things. You've got to look at the level of investment in a society. You've got to look at how tight labor markets are. You have to look at the tax take and how it varies across the income distribution. You also just have to look at a variety of other things. You know, what is the general climate? What is the level of demand? What is the state of the financial system? Can business owners get access to loans? Any number of things. You need a comprehensive strategy to really address the question of take-home pay and the question of wages.
And you mentioned payroll tax cuts, family-friendly tax reform, a larger earned income tax credit, and wage subsidies. Let me take that last one. How do you mean wage subsidies?
There are a variety of different ways you might want to approach this, but the issue is that for many people at the low end of the labor market, people who have limited skills, the wages that are available to them, the market wages that are available to them, are in some cases too low to really draw people into the workforce. So there are a variety of strategies you might want to pursue to make work more attractive. You can call this idea of making work pay. It's an idea that both Republicans have championed and also Democrats like President Obama. And wage subsidies can take many, many different forms. Right now, we have a wage subsidy called the Earned Income Tax Credit that is frankly pretty convoluted, that offers much bigger benefits to workers with children than to workers without children. And that creates a lot of problems, and also a lot of problems as people's market wage goes up over time, which is what you want. As people gain experience, they can command a higher market wage, but in a lot of cases, they wind up losing some of those wage subsidies and other benefits. So you've got to think about this in a more comprehensive way to ensure that people are not punished for climbing the economic ladder.
Do you have an example, like maybe a kind of job or a kind of income that would be subsidized by the government in terms of wages? In what way?
Well, one thing to keep in mind is that we already subsidize all kinds of employment. There are many different kinds of safety net programs, some of which are for those who do not or cannot work. But there are many other programs that are designed to offer supports for people who are in work. Some people call these in-work benefits. So, this could be Medicaid. It could be SNAP for low-wage workers, any number of things. This is not a new idea, the idea of subsidizing people who are low-wage workers. What is new, hopefully, is the idea of actually trying to think about this a bit more comprehensively and also thinking about people throughout their life course. So it's not just a matter of helping someone when someone has a child. It might also be a matter of, let's say, making a less skilled person a more attractive marriage partner. Think about teenagers. In the United States right now, there's a huge number of teenagers who want work opportunities, whether part-time or otherwise, but who can't get them. There's a huge number of people locked out of this labor force. Now, the problem is that if you are locked out of the labor force as a teenager, it's a lot less likely that you will succeed in the labor market later on when you're older, because for many folks, they learn lots of skills, non-cognitive skills, etc. So one thing you might do is think about, how do we target those people at the earliest phase of their careers? So that's one of the areas that you'd want to look at if you were thinking comprehensively about improving people's economic prospects. All people.
Are either Trump or Clinton proposing anything like you've been describing so far?
Well, there have been Democrats and Republicans, leaving the presidential candidates aside, who've talked about things like apprenticeship programs. Hillary Clinton has adopted a proposal that was championed by a Republican senator, Tim Scott, among others, that would basically make the idea of an apprenticeship, which is basically a way of combining on-the-job learning, some classroom-based study, with actual work experience, to make that more attractive for firms. We've seen in other countries like Britain, Germany, Austria, that apprenticeships are oftentimes a very good way to kind of grease the wheels, to get people, particularly young people who might be disconnected from the labor force, valuable experience. And companies often like it very much because, this way they get trained, experienced workers. But the truth is that this is not something either candidate has talked about all that much. And I'd say that's because of the nature of competition. When you have two candidates who are competing to offer a set of ideas that are compelling for working class people, for disconnected young people, et cetera, then you have more of an incentive to talk about these things, to think hard about them. When you don't have that kind of debate, you wind up talking about totally different issues. You don't talk about the plight of working class Americans. You talk about different outrageous things Donald Trump is saying, let's say, or you have Donald Trump trying to attack Hillary Clinton and make her seem unacceptable to right-leaning voters, so forth and so on.
Reihan Salaam with us, executive editor of National Review, Slate columnist, co-author with Ross Douthat of Grand New Party, How Conservatives Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Maybe you saw their joint op-ed in the Times a couple of weeks ago, and we're looking at Donald Trump's economic speech yesterday in Detroit through the eyes of Reihan Salaam and what his wing of thinkers, sometimes called reformicons, see. And listeners, we can take your phone calls with questions for Reihan about his ideas or with your reactions to the Trump speech on the economy, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Your article mentions family-friendly tax reform. Here's a 12-second clip from Trump's speech yesterday. I think the audio on this is a little glitchy, but it's just 12 seconds and people will get the idea.
My plan will also help reduce the cost of childcare by allowing parents to fully deduct the average cost of childcare spending from their taxes.
Fully deduct the cost of childcare from their taxes. That's so potentially sweeping when we think of everything as parents that we spend on our children. And liberal economists have been critiquing this today as the wealthiest parents would get a much bigger tax cut on their child care than lower income ones, for obvious reasons. If you're taking a percentage of your expenses and you're making a lot more money, spending a lot more money on your kids, and you're in a higher tax bracket, this is actually going to put a lot more tax dollars back in the pockets of wealthier parents. Did Trump miss the mark, or what do you think of that part of his proposal?
To be clear, he referred to the average childcare cost. So that means that if I'm someone who is spending an unusually high amount because I have a very high income, I'm not going to get the full cost of it. It's going to be the average. It's still a terrible idea. One of the reasons it's a terrible idea is that presumably the families you want to help are those that have modest incomes. It happens that for people with modest incomes, the federal income taxes they pay tend to be pretty low. And in some cases, you have a lot of workers who don't really have federal income tax liability at all. Instead, they'll pay something like the Social Security payroll tax. That's going to be their chief federal tax burden. So a proposal like this, and again, there are no real details, as is often the case with proposals that Donald Trump floats. It's actually a lot of guesswork around what exactly it means. But you know, if you don't have some refundable credit, then people who are not paying income taxes right now don't see any benefit from this. So it's not quite right to say that it's going to be ultra-rich people who spend tens of thousands of dollars who are going to sort of completely eliminate their tax liability, because again, it's the average cost. But it's also true that the people you'd presumably really want to help, which is struggling working class parents of young children, it's not clear that they're going to be helped by this much at all.
Now, you suggest in your article no new income tax cuts for households earning more than $250,000 a year. That sounds like something Hillary Clinton might say. How is it conservative?
Well, to be clear, what Hillary Clinton might say is that we want higher taxes for people above $250,000 a year. Now, when you look at Bill Clinton, her husband, he did something very shrewd back in the 1990s. He recognized that many people believed that Democrats wanted to raise taxes for everyone, and that wasn't an illusion. That, you know, Walter Mondale explicitly said that he was going to raise people's taxes, because he believed that, hey, we have these big deficits, everyone is going to need to pay something. And so that was something that was electorally poisonous. Now, if you look fast forward to the future, Republicans have a different problem. Their problem isn't that people believe that they're going to raise everyone's taxes, because it's been hammered home that Republicans are the party of tax cuts. What people are skeptical about is whether they are going to benefit from those tax cuts, or if it's only going to be very rich people. Now, I happen to believe that tax cuts for high-end folks might actually be a good and useful thing. It can enhance growth here and there. The problem is that there's a trust problem. People don't trust Republicans to advance tax cuts that benefit, again, ordinary middle-class people. So that's where the pledge comes from. The idea is that until we have sustainable budget surpluses, we are not going to seek to cut taxes for the rich. Instead, we're going to seek to cut taxes for working people, people with children, others who have been squeezed in recent years. And again, that's not because tax cuts for the rich are a bad thing or that we want to raise taxes on rich people. Rather, it's about promoting this idea that you can trust us, because no, we are not going to just have yawning deficits in order to benefit the highest earners.
There could be some disagreement around that,
mm-hmm. but you know, I think that that's a sensible place to start given the extent of distrust.
It goes to the fundamental idea of your book and your political philosophy, I think, that the Republican leadership has been trying to appeal to the white working class largely while really offering benefits to upper income people. And so that's where a lot of the loss of trust of the Republican elites comes from potential Republican voters, right?
Well, and I'd say that that's not unique to the Republican Party, certainly. But yes, I do believe that that is a challenge. And when you're looking at what's happening right now, what's happening over the last, you know, 5-6 years and will continue to happen in the future, is that the party coalitions are changing. In 2012, for the first time since 1964, Democrats won a plurality of households that earn more than $250,000 a year. That is going to be even more the case in the 2016 election. So Democrats now represent many folks who are low income and also many folks who are very high income, whereas Republicans represent people in the middle. The problem Republicans have is that they represent white people in the middle, meaning the lower middle class, the middle class. Now, you know, that area between, let's say, $35,000 a year and $250,000 a year. So what we want to do is ensure that the Republican Party is the party of the middle, not just the white middle, but this larger pan-ethnic middle. And that is part of why we believe in a different policy mix that is going to be about upward mobility for everyone in that broad group. So of course you want to win over some voters who are wealthier, and you certainly want to win over aspirational voters who are too poor to fall into that middle now, who aspire to being part of that middle. But that is the broader strategy, given how the two parties have changed.
Mm-hmm. And you're right that similarly, Republicans need to rethink how they talk about health care and retirement. On health care, you basically say something like, Obamacare is here to stay. So is there a genuine conservative option other than repeal and replace?
I believe that there are many good, genuine options that would involve repealing and replacing Obamacare. The trouble is that what Democrats and Republicans forget is that no matter how big you might win in one election, you might lose in the next election. Our political system, our constitutional order, is designed in a way where in order to pass durable policy proposals, in order to have sweeping policy change, you need overlapping majorities. You can't just win the presidency. You need to have the House. You have to have the Senate, et cetera. And the truth is that we have a lot of divided government in this country because our parties are pretty closely divided. So in 2008, people thought we're going to have a huge realignment. Barack Obama has come in. He's going to pass these huge sweeping proposals. But then in 2010, you had the Republicans come back in. You have this kind of seesaw effect. So what you need are policies that are going to last past one election. They're going to last past one disastrous election for your party. That means that, maybe you could imagine a world in which Republicans have so much success that they can repeal Obamacare. But will they be able to replace it with something that is more durably popular? Or will Democrats come in and just bring Obamacare back? That's what a lot of Republicans who want to repeal Obamacare fail to reckon with. They fail to accept the fact that whether you like Obamacare or not, it actually was meeting certain political anxieties. And so Republicans who want to succeed have to address those same anxieties and concerns when they're trying to fix the system. And, again, we could talk about exactly what we ought to do. One thing to start looking at is the exchanges and changing the way those exchanges work. But, that's more of a nitty-gritty question. What you first have to acknowledge is that Republicans are not going to be in power for 50 or 60 years. Neither will Democrats. You have to recognize that your political opponents are always going to be out there.
And similarly, one place I think you agree with Trump, or Trump agrees with you, is that Republicans should do more to reassure people about Social Security and Medicare rather than emphasize that they're unsustainable or try to privatize them, as some Republicans have. Now, when you take all this together that we've talked about so far, some conservatives say this makes Trump a big government conservative, whatever that is. Some say this all makes your brand conservatism more like liberalism light. Do you accept that label for Trump or for yourself?
Well, look, if we're talking about Trump and myself, we're talking about two very different things. If you're talking about Trump, the fundamental issue is that there isn't really a ton of coherence. So on the one hand, he's saying that he doesn't want to touch Social Security and Medicare. But then he's also saying, which seems like something that's a kind of working class friendly position. But then he's advancing other proposals that are not going to do much good for working class folks. What we're advancing is a pretty different set of ideas. So, for example, with regard to Social Security, we're not saying that we're going to leave Social Security untouched, which is what Donald Trump says. We are saying we are going to make Social Security a better deal for people who've earned low wages their entire lives. And we are going to see to it that richer people have to rely more on their private savings when they're older because they can. That's going to be something that is going to make the system more sustainable. We care about fiscal sustainability. We care about ensuring that budgets are sound over a longer period of time. Donald Trump does not. So that's one big difference. And as to whether or not this is liberalism light, look, there are a lot of big differences which, for example, flow from what are your beliefs about cultural and social issues. What are your beliefs about immigration and other issues of that kind? And also, what are your beliefs about how, let's say, government employment ought to work? So for many folks on the left, they believe, and there are all kinds of reasons to believe this, that you want to have collective bargaining in public employment. For folks on the right, the view is that, look, government is about delivering services to people and doing that as cheaply and efficiently as possible. Those are two goals that are oftentimes in tension. So, of course, there's going to be some areas of overlap because the truth is that, Americans of all different stripes, they want public schools. They want to guarantee that older people who have limited resources have access to healthcare. But there are many other areas where they disagree. And the debate is not just about how much in taxes do the richest people of all play. It might be, do we want to reward people who are aspirational and who want to work? Or do we want to ensure that, let's say, everyone has something like a guaranteed minimum income? These are big ideological disagreements mm-hmm. that are different from the ones that we've been talking about in the past, but they're the ones that we ought to be talking about in the future.
We're talking about Donald Trump's economy speech yesterday in Detroit through the eyes of Raihan Salam, National Review executive editor, Slate columnist, and co-author of Grand New Party, How Conservatives Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream, the book he wrote for the 2008 campaign with New York Times columnist Ross Douthat. And maybe you saw their thoughtful update of that book for the 2016 campaign as an op-ed in the Times a couple of weeks ago. These, as you know, if you read Ross in the Times or read Reihan on Slater National Review, these are not Trump supporters, but these are other people who are trying to break out of Republican economic orthodoxy to apply conservative principles, but in a more realistic way for today. 212-433-WNYC. If you want to react, we'll get to immigration, we'll get to trade, but right now we'll get to Chris in Soho. You're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Yes, hi, Brian.
Go ahead.
Well, I'd like to point out that, in 1958, General Electric was the largest private employer, and they paid the equivalent of $38 an hour, which was the American dream. That was sending your kid to school, buying a house, buying a car. Today, the largest private employer is Walmart, which pays about $11 an hour. So it seems to me that the, we all know manpower, labor is the highest expenditure for a business, and it just seems that the money is not going where it needs to go.
Reihan, where would you start with that?
There are lots of ways to think about this, one of which is that if you're looking at the mid-1950s, that was a pretty unusual time for lots of reasons, one of which is that most of the world's other major economies were still devastated by war and recovering. Also, in the United States, if you look at the labor market, it looked really, really different. Women did not work in large numbers. You had other groups of people who, while the kind of, let's say, white middle-class people worked for GE were doing well, you had a lot of other people, African-Americans, for example, who were really very tightly constrained. They were margined. They were on the margins. They were kind of cordoned off into kind of low-wage slices of the economy. Today, we have a much more inclusive and competitive economy. We also have had a pretty dramatic change in the composition of the workforce because of high levels of immigration and many other things. I'm not saying that these things are good or bad. I'm saying that the labor market today and the global economic environment, they're both very, very different. That does not mean we couldn't have done a better job. We could have done a much better job. And one way we could do a better job is ensuring, well, part of it is something that everyone agrees with, Democrats and Republicans, is that we need to ensure that our workers have the best skills. Another thing, however, is that if you think about Walmart, Walmart is a firm that doesn't face a lot of competition in large swaths of the country. And there are a lot of businesses like that. This is one reason why corporate profits have been so high in recent years, because basically you have far fewer startups that are competing with incumbents. When you have new companies competing with old companies, those old companies have to shape up. They have to compete by, among other things, attracting the best employees. How do you do that? You do that by bidding up wages. If you have companies that are not competing for any number of reasons, we can get into that later on, then, well, why should I offer higher wages if I don't have seven other employers around the block waiting to steal away my employees? So in a way, the problem we have is that we have a safety net for corporations that sees to it that they're not subjected to tons of competition, whereas low-wage workers are subjected to pretty fierce competition, not only competition that's domestic from other workers here, but also competition that's global. So you'd want to think hard about that. How do we make the competitive environment much tougher for the companies and for the employers? And how do we see to it that employees, that workers, are in a better position to compete?
Is this where immigration comes in? Because that, of course, is a Trump centerpiece. And in your article, you seem to agree that we should bring in fewer unskilled workers, both for purely economic reasons and because you say they're more likely to assimilate downward. What does assimilate downward mean? Is that an economic statement?
Well, Brian, you've asked a few questions at once. So the first thing I'll say is that Donald Trump is largely talking about immigration in the language of cultural threat, the idea that foreigners are dangerous, they want to harm Americans and much else, and that's absolutely not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a very kind of simple and straightforward point. When you're looking at the economy over the last 30, 40 years, what we've seen is that people with low skill levels, people who don't have a high school diploma, let's say, they're really struggling. they need help from the government in the form of Medicaid, SNAP, the Earned Income Tax Credit, and what have you, through no fault of their own. These are good, hardworking people who need a lot of help. But when you think about bringing new people into the country who also need that help, there are a number of different challenges, one of which is that if you bring in lots of people with limited skills rather than people with high skills, well, you have more people with limited skills competing to be service workers serving people who have high skills and high incomes. If you did something different, if you brought in lots of people with high skills and high incomes, you flip the script. You have Americans, including immigrants who live here right now, by the way, Brian, they have less competition, and then those affluent people have to pay more for different services. Now, rich people aren't going to like that necessarily, but that is flipping the script so that instead of actually giving working class people a tougher time, you're giving the rich people who are consumers a slightly tougher time. And I think that that seems like a fair trade-off to me. There are other elements. When you talk about assimilating downward, here's the thing. When you're a very poor immigrant, you are much better off than you were in your native country. But the trouble is that you yourself are pretty poor, so you oftentimes can't ensure that your children have the tools they need, have access to the neighborhoods and the schools and the other things they need in order to climb into the middle class and the upper middle class. So one difficulty we have is that while a poor immigrant might have, you know, be really grateful to be in the United States, their child living in a high poverty neighborhood oftentimes really struggles. If you have an immigration policy that only thinks about the first generation and doesn't think about the life chances of people who grew up poor in America, who really struggle, you're not thinking about the long term. So this is not about immigrants being bad. It's not about less skilled immigrants being bad people. It's about thinking about the fact that we have automation and other economic trends that are that might actually make life for less skilled people even harder in the future than they already have been over the last 30 years. So eventually, if we get our economic house in order, we might once again be in a position to welcome these folks. But right now, this is a fraught moment where I believe we need more people who are going to be paying high tax rates, they're going to be earning high incomes, so that we have less skilled, low-wage American workers in a better position, and so we have less inequality.
Mark Zandi, chief economist for Moody's Analytics, was here last week. And he said a big problem for economic growth in the future will be a labor shortage, and that we actually need a lot of low-skill, low-education immigrants because there'd even be a labor shortage on that end of the labor force. I guess you disagree with that.
Brian, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Brian. That is a great point. This is another reason why people disagree about the minimum wage. Because there are some people who believe that we can have a higher minimum wage, because when you have a higher minimum wage, what companies do is they invest in machinery. They make jobs more productive by applying more capital. If you have a lot of low-wage workers, then you don't need to make those investments. This is one reason why in a country like Denmark or in Japan, fast food workers earn a lot more money than they do in the United States. Why? Not because employers there are benevolent or great people, it's because they have to. They have no choice because they don't have an availability of large numbers of low-skilled workers. So what Mark Zandi is saying is that given the existing way businesses work, then you need a lot of low-skilled workers. But if employers find, gosh, we have to compete for these workers, well, we'd better start investing in them. We'd better start paying them higher wages. It's a different story because business models aren't static. The way that we, let's say, run an automobile plant today in 2016 is very different than the way we ran it in 1926 because, again, we apply more machinery rather than having a ton of low-wage workers. And that's something that employers are not going to do that by choice. If they had the option of hiring people at extremely low wages and having taxpayers pay for their health care, pay for their EITC, pay for their food stamps, of course they're going to pay them extremely low wages. But if they find that, wait a second, our supply of these low-wage workers is lower, so we have to pay these low-wage workers much higher wages, you see what I mean? The business model changes in response to the changing economic conditions. If you assume that construction is going to be the exact same in the year 2026 as it is today, that there are going to be no machines, there's going to be no automation, well, that's one thing. But if you believe that automation and innovation is proceeding apace, then the labor market is definitely going to change.
Suha in Millburn. You're on WNYC with Raihan Salam. Hello, Suha.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
So I didn't actually watch the Trump speech, but I just heard, you know, some of the comments. And specifically what I wanted to talk about is the, you know, the child tax deduction, which, again, goes to prove that, you know, whenever Donald Trump speaks, he doesn't know what he's talking about.
And do I understand you're an accountant? You're a tax professional? Is that right?
Yes, I'm a tax professional. So I wanted to comment on that because, you know, it's not so simple, and it's not just you can't just say a full deduction. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean at the end of the day that the taxpayer is going to, you know, have a benefit? And because ultimately that's what you want. You know, first of all, you know, is it a deduction that is going to offset your income? And for some of these lower wage folks, may not even have a tax liability. So does that give them a credit? Is it a tax deduction that, you know, is it the concept of an itemized deduction, which, you know, 99%, if not 100% of the time, is subject to limitations? So, I mean, just another example of how, you know, how vague or how uninformed or not fully informed Donald Trump is.
Well,
and
he would
say that's really frustrating.
Well, when he says the full average cost of childcare, you certainly would have to flesh out the details, and the tax code would have to say what's included as allowable childcare deductions in that. So thank you for pointing that out. Reihan, here's one more clip from the Trump speech on an issue central to his campaign, as everybody knows, how we're getting shortchanged on trade. And he uses one trade deal that's rarely in the headlines as an example.
Let's talk about South Korea for a moment. Because it's perfectly, and it just perfectly illustrates the broken promises that have hurt so many American workers. President Obama and the usual so-called experts who've been wrong about every trade deal for decades predicted that the trade deal with South Korea would increase our exports to South Korea by more than $10 billion, resulting in some 70,000 jobs. Like Hillary Clinton's broken promises to New York, these pledges all turned out to be false. Instead of creating 70,000 jobs, it has killed nearly 100,000 jobs, according to the Economic Policy Institute. Our exports to South Korea haven't increased at all, but their imports to us have surged more than $15 billion. More than doubling our trade deficit with that country.
A minute of Trump yesterday on the South Korea trade deal. And Reihan, I think you're more of a free trade proponent. What did you think of that stretch and the numbers in it?
Well, one of the challenges here is that people do sell free trade agreements in very misleading ways. Whether you support them or oppose them, that's simply true. So when you think about something like a trade agreement between the United States and South Korea, you know, you have politicians selling it on the grounds that it's going to generate more jobs. But the subtler truth is that really opening our markets, lowering our tariff barriers, is really about subjecting domestic producers, domestic employers, to higher levels of competition. For a variety of reasons, one of which is that you want to give consumers more choices and you want to lower consumer prices. Another political economy reason is that you want to see to it that you don't have fat, lazy companies that are not serving the interests of consumers. So, you know, those are things that are things that you tend not to hear in the political argument, that are actually a pretty big part of the story. So if you're looking at how we've approached our trade deals, what we tend to do is seek these bilateral or multilateral agreements that say that we are going to lower our barriers if you also lower your barriers. And one challenge is that, you know, in many other countries, you have lots of non-tariff barriers that relate to things like intellectual property rights and much else. The irony is that another trade agreement that Donald Trump opposes, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, is actually all about addressing those non-tariff barriers that would potentially allow U.S. firms to become more competitive. But another wrinkle is that when you're talking about U.S. firms, a lot of big U.S. companies are multinationals. They have operations all over the world. So to Donald Trump, the global economy is about one country competing against another country. The more complicated truth is that our big multinational companies are companies that have operations in all kinds of different parts of the world. And so the issue is not so much how do our companies do, the issue is how do our workers do. And our workers might actually do well if you have a company like BMW coming to South Carolina or coming to Alabama. You might actually do well by making the United States a more attractive home for foreign investment. So when you talk about trade in these kind of zero-sum terms, you miss the fact that, again, what we want to do is make employers, whether they're U.S. employers or foreign employers, fight for U.S. workers. I would ideally want them to be fighting over our less skilled, mid-skilled, middle-class workers. And that's not what's happening right now. So I don't believe that imposing tariffs on South Korean goods is the way forward, but we need to have a smarter economic strategy that's based on making this country much more attractive. And I think that the reason why Donald Trump is getting purchased by making these kinds of, you know, frankly, pretty ignorant attacks is because the people on the other side, the people who've been selling these trade agreements, haven't actually done a good job of explaining what would make the American economy go forward.
And there we will leave it. With Raihan Salam, executive editor of National Review, Slate columnist, and co-author with Ross Douthat of Grand New Party, How Conservatives Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream, published in 2008, and the related op-ed piece that the two of them put in the New York Times last month called A Cure for Trumpism. Really interesting stuff, Raihan. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, what's in a think tank? Is it thought or is it special interest agendas? We'll look at the result of an investigative report. Stay with us.